Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello, welcome to the Bitcoin Standard Seminar Podcast. Today's guest is Professor Philip Bagus, Professor of Economics at the Universidad Juan Carlos, and author of In Defense of Deflation, a book which I think is the most definitive Austrian treatment and complete Austrian treatment of the topic of deflation. Professor Bagus's book predates Bitcoin. It was written in, I think, 2007 is when you handed in your PhD thesis. And then it was published by an academic press in 2014. And it's a very thorough study of the topic of deflation through centuries of economic thought. And it has the most comprehensive treatment of the topic. So I'm very happy to have Philip join us today. Philip, thank you for coming.
Yeah, thank you, Saifdean. It's a great pleasure and honor to be with you today.
Thank you. The pleasure is all ours. I think this is going to be a lot of fun. So could you let us know the main ideas in your book on deflation? Why do you defend the deflation?
Yeah, I started to write, as you said, my PhD thesis on deflation. In 2003, I started to study systematically in deflation. Why? Because there's been much written on inflation and on deflation. There was not so much written, of course. And most importantly, deflation is presented always as a dangerous threat that has to be fighted with all means. It's like the most horrible thing, deflation. And what is the medicine against deflation? It's, of course, inflation. And all people who benefit from inflation defend it vigorously, or the thesis that deflation is so horrible, so harmful. So I looked into it, and I found something that I had also suspected, that all these arguments against deflation that presented as something so harmful are wrong. And therefore, I wrote my thesis on it, not with this title, but then the title for my book, In Defense of Deflation, of course, to defend deflation against a bad image, which I think is very important, because all these inflationary monetary policies that we are suffering from are also justified by this deflation argument.
So in your book, you begin with an overview of the historical arguments against deflation, because generally people didn't really defend deflation because it wasn't much of an issue historically. But we do begin in the 19th century to see people complaining about deflation. So what is the substance of the argument against deflation historically?
Yeah, an interesting thing that I found out is that these people who came up with the first arguments against deflation, with the wrong deflation theories, most of them were bankers and industrialists that had made a fortune during artificial booms. And then when it came to credit contractions, they, of course, were against it because they were losing everything. So they came up with arguments about aggregate demand and that there's not enough demand, so deflation would be bad. Before that, deflation was not much an issue. In fact, Adam Smith basically does not talk about deflation, and you can only read through the lines, because when he discusses, for example, economic growth, he never says something about that price deflation could be a problem resulting from economic growth. Yeah, so most of the classics don't see a problem there, but then there is the first people, proto-Keynesians, that come up with these ideas, and then it gets, of course, worse with Keynesianism and neoclassical theory in the 20th century.
Yeah, 20th century is when the crazy really started. And you point at Irving Fisher and Keynes for the deflation phobia. So do you want to give us an overview of their arguments? What is the Fisher and Keynes argument against the deflation?
Yeah, the argument by Irving Fisher is his debt deflation spiral, that when there's a recession, then there are bankruptcies, then these companies cannot pay back their loans to the banks, so the banks have to restrict credits further, and then prices fall. And as debts are fixed nominally, all companies that are indebted will get more problems due to the falling price level. They will default, this leading to more problems for the banks that have to restrict credit further, to more price inflation, and so on, in a spiral that takes down basically the whole economy. So this is Irving Fisher's argument. And Keynes' argument is more related to the problems of, let's say, the liquidity trap. Yeah, in a liquidity trap, when interest rates are close to zero, then it's argued when there are deflationary expectations, then real interest rates would be too high. And then no one would invest in this situation because of deflationary expectations. These are the most prominent academic theories against deflation, I would say.
Yeah, Keynes was really responsible for a lot of this. And also his argument was also about the lack of spending, that people will become afraid of spending. So it is kind of similar to the Fisher argument in ultimately they both describe a cycle of bad things happening, and the common factor is that there's no mechanism for price feedback to arrest the problem. It just continues to get worse because there's no price feedback that, maybe if workers are getting paid less and prices of goods are smaller, then workers can get paid a smaller salary and buy the cheaper goods, and then life goes on. This kind of adjustment process does not go on, does not occur to them, because I think this is very much a market process. And in the Fisher and Keynes method of treating economics, you can't really mathematicize this very easily. So it doesn't really end up showing up. There's no mechanism for arresting the deflationary spiral. Lower prices mean fewer people want to spend. Fewer people spending means fewer people get hired. And then that means fewer wages, so less spending. And then it just continues to spiral until we get to zero. Unless, of course, the government intervenes and saves us with a lot of inflation, of course. So a common theme in all of these is that the answer is always inflation, of course. When we think about deflation, you do a very good systematic job of dividing the different kinds of deflation that we can see. And because people use this term in many ways. So first of all, we should be clear, there's price deflation, and then there's supply deflation. And you want to tell us the difference between the two?
Yeah, well, I call it monetary deflation. Monetary deflation is when the money supply actually decreases. Yeah, this is something that would not occur in a 100% gold standard or does not occur with Bitcoin. And then we have a possible effect, a ceteris paribus effect of a monetary deflation, which is price deflation, which is a fall into general price level. Yeah, my book is about price deflation. Why? Because the mainstream, basically, when they talk about deflation, what they mean is price deflation. What they fear is price deflation. They do not only fear monetary deflation, they also fear falling prices in general. They're independent of the cause, actually. They don't talk about the cause when they say just there's a deflationary price expectations. They don't say why. You know, why do people think that prices will fall? Well, if it's due to economic growth, apparently it seems to be a problem for them also. Yeah, so there's monetary deflation or supply deflation, if you want to call it this way. That is a decrease in the money supply, and then there's a general decrease in the price level, which is actually what central banks fight against. Yeah.
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifeddin.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
Yeah. Yeah. And so then what are the causes of deflation? In chapter 3 of the book, you go through 4 different examples of deflation, 4 different ways in which we can see deflation. And here you're referring to price deflation. So the first one is economic growth. That's the most horrible, of course. It's when things become cheaper and people can afford more.
this should be the general tendency in a market economy. There are increases in productivity due to new technologies, due to capital accumulation, due to innovations, higher division of labor, and so on. More goods are produced. If the productivity rises faster than the supply of money, then prices tend to fall. That is something natural, and it has occurred in history many, many times without any problems. It was accompanied by high economic growth. It did not stop the high economic growth. Actually, it was the effect of the high economic growth, not the increases in productivity. It happened in the 19th century for more than over 30 years in the United States, also in other countries. And it has occurred again and again. It's the best thing imaginable. It's a natural thing. It's also like it spreads like it's like a dividend. The increase in productivity due to the savings of capitalists and so on give a dividend to the general population of these efforts in form of lower prices.
Yeah. One thing that I like to bring up in relation to this is something called the Simon Abundance Index. In my book, The Bitcoin Standard, and in my coming two books, the textbook Principles of Economics and The Fiat Standard, I bring this up. I keep talking about Julian Simon. I like his work, and he explained how time is the ultimate scarce resource and humans are the ultimate scarce resource. We see here, it shows us 50 basic commodities and it shows the changes in terms of time price. He measures how much the price of those things has changed in terms of the wage of the average worker. And so he looks at the average worker wage in 1980. And this is not Simon, it's been made in honor of Simon by economist Gail Pooley. He looks at the price of these commodities over 39 years, almost 40 years, as measured in terms of how much time you need to work in order to buy them. And so if you were the average worker in 1980 and you wanted to buy coffee, you had to work a specific amount of time to buy a specific quantity of coffee. Today, you need to work 86.8% less. So this gets rid of the problems of inflation and the measurement of inflation and the value of money and the real value of money. And we're just measuring in terms of the wage. So how many cups of coffee can you buy per hour, or sugar or cocoa or aluminum or corn or tea or fertilizer? And you look for 50 commodities, the numbers range from negative 86% to the zinc is the one that has become cheaper, least of all 50, and it has become a third cheaper. It's 34%. So somewhere between 34 and 86%, 50 commodities. This is the range of what has happened to them in 40 years. So in 40 years, everything has gotten significantly cheaper. So you can get, if you look at this multiplier column here, it shows you the abundance multiplier, how much more you can get of all of these things in terms of the time that we could have put in them in 1980. And you see here, it's 1.5. The lowest is zinc, which you get 50% more. But for coffee, sugar, silver, it's 7 times as much. So you can buy 7 times as much coffee, sugar, silver, pork, uranium, are about 6 times as much for the same amount of time of work. So if you look at what is happening in the world in the last 40 years, you know, if you're actually looking at the economics, we see that everything is getting cheaper. Things are just continuously getting cheaper in real terms, in terms of the time that we need to spend. You know, if you were working in 1980, you had to work a lot more to buy the same quantity of coffee, sugar, cotton, lamb, aluminum, whatever, that you are able to buy today. So it's natural that prices of these things should drop. I think it's absolutely amazing that people don't think this is normal. You know, we can buy so much more coffee today than we did 40 years ago. We can buy so much more of everything. Everything is just so much more abundant. So it would be normal to expect that prices continue to drop. And yet people have been conditioned basically to think this is a problem, that we can't have prices decline. We need to fix this somehow. And of course, the answer, the solution is inflation. Okay, so that's the first kind of deflation, growth. And then there's the cash building deflation. What causes that?
This is when people, for some reason, want to hold a higher real cash balance. So you can distinguish between nominal cash balance is what you demand, your nominal demand for money, let's say your nominal demand for money to hold as cash is $1,000. The real cash balance demand is how much cash you want as purchasing power. How much do you want to be able to purchase? Yeah, this is the cash building demand is what you want to hold as a reserve to be able to make purchases. Yeah, because the future is uncertain, so you don't want what will happen, what you will want to buy in the future, if there will be emergencies and so on. So you always want to hold some money. Otherwise, you would invest everything. You would hold no money at all, right? You would invest everything to get a return, but not the future is uncertain. So you want to hold money. So there are several reasons why you would like to hold more money in real terms. Yeah. One reason would be what I mentioned, that uncertainty is expected or does increase because there's something, a war or something. Yeah. There might be also due to speculation, because you think that the purchasing power of your money will increase, so you want to hold more of it. Yeah. You think that the money, the price or the purchasing power of the money will increase in the future, so you buy more of it. The quality, if you think that the quality is expected to increase or does increase, you also want to hold more of it. So these are the basic reasons why you would like to hold more money. Yeah, and if you demand more money, then of course, ceteris paribus, the price of money increases, which is the purchasing power of money increases, which means prices of goods and services fall. There's a price deflation. In the market economy, this is not a problem. People want to hold higher real cash balances. Even if there's no more money around, they can do so. How? Well, they just abstain from buying and increase their selling. Yeah. And if everyone wants to do it, what will happen? Well, prices will fall. And if everyone wants to hold a higher real cash balance and stops buying and increases selling, prices will fall and everyone will hold a higher real cash balances, because prices have fallen. So the market solves this problem of people wanting to have a higher real cash balance by falling prices. So here, price deflation is not a problem. It's exactly the solution to what people want. They, for some reason, want to hold a higher real cash balances, and they get it through the market, through falling prices.
Yeah, and it's amazing when you think about it. You know, just like with any good, supply and demand responds to individuals' incentives. In the case of cash balances, when people demand cash balances, let's say because there's a crisis, there's a war, there's a pandemic, the future is becoming more uncertain, bad things are happening, there's an earthquake. In this situation, you know, people will hoard more cash, and that means that goods will become cheaper. Money will become more expensive, goods will become cheaper. And think about it, this is exactly what governments today are trying to achieve with all of their monetary interventions in the face of the coronavirus crisis, in that, you know, they're trying to help people by giving them money. But in a free market system with a deflationary fixed supply currency, as people rush to the money, the value of the money rises. And that in itself is kind of the stimulus that people get, because everything becomes cheaper in real terms, you know. So because people are hoarding money, fewer people are buying food that they don't need. And so the price of foods will drop in return for money. So it's a market response that is like all market responses. It works in alleviating the problems that brought it about. That's essentially what it does. And of course, it's, when you think about it this way, it's very weird that people like Keynes and Fisher pathologize this this aspect. You know, in a crisis, you want things to get cheaper. You want people to have cheaper things, and the way that things get cheaper is that people hoard money. That's one way in which it happens. So they stop spending the money, and the price of things declines.
I mean, they use the term hoarding, which is already have like a negative connotation, no? So this is already a sneaky way to make your argument to talk about hoarding, because it's supposed to be something negative, no? Therefore, it's better to talk about cash building, because it's a more neutral way and not... So you see this, they are actually saying that they are value neutral and objective, but they smuggle in their valuations already with the language they use.
If you're using equations, then you can smuggle in all value judgments you want, as long as you put them in numbers. So you can call it hoarding if you have equations. All right, so that's the second way in which we get deflation, is in which people demand more cash. And then the third way is bank credit deflation.
Yeah, this is what would not happen on a free market, because it only happens due to our intervened and privileged fractional reserve banking system, where banks can create money out of thin air. Mm-hmm. There's an artificial boom. And then when the bust comes, there's normally a credit contraction, which central banks, of course, fight against it. But if it runs its course, it would be, well, there's a malinvestments are liquidated, so these companies cannot pay back their loans, therefore banks will have losses, then people lost confidence in the fractional reserve banks, get their money out, they lose even, and then the banks have to restrict credits, yeah, and prices fall due to this reduction of the money supply. This is actually then a monetary deflation also there, because the money supply is reduced. Yeah, what Soto also says always, well, in the fractional reserve banking system, it's like an accordion, the money supply. It easily expands and then it easily contracts again, something that would not happen in a free market monetary system. So, but this is, of course, also something good because it speeds up the liquidation of the malinvestments. You could work against it. You could try to prop up these malinvestments. But then the resources that are urgently needed to restructure the economy, to start new investment projects, these resources would then be stuck in the malinvestments. Bankruptcies are something good in a market economy, because they liberate resources and they direct them from people who are use them in a bad way to people who can use them in a better way to satisfy consumer wishes. So a bank credit deflation is actually something that speeds up the recovery because it also leads to more savings normally, because there will be higher interest rates and people tend to save more, and this then there are more resources available and more money available to finance new projects and start the recovery. Of course, we have to say this would not occur in a free market because there would be no bank credit inflation or credit expansion. But if we live in such a system, then it's actually something positive that these malinvestments are liquidated quickly.
Yeah, I think, even inflationists would agree. Inflationists wouldn't agree, but who cares what they agree with. But I think reasonable people would agree that the best way of preventing this kind of deflation would be not to cause it in the first place with unnecessary credit creation. Where people disagree is going to be about what is necessary and correct credit creation and what is excessive and inflationary. It would be great if we had a free market, because we would be able to test this empirically, but we don't, unfortunately. We don't have a free market in credit and banking. These are not free market institutions. There is no room for free market competition, and therefore regulations imposed by governments are what determine the shape of these industries. And therefore, we end up with the credit cycle that is subsidized effectively by government currency. It's undertaken. Credit expansion is undertaken with effectively the backing of the national currency, and inevitably it collapses and then it falls apart. In a sense, the collapse is the fact that the credit system continuously collapses is why it continues to survive, because it's why they can't get as much inflation as they would like. But if they could get the inflation and it didn't collapse periodically, then we just have much bigger runaway inflation happening all the time, I think. But, all of these deflationary crises are arguably what continue to give national currencies a lot of their value. Imagine if we didn't have all these corrections over the last 40, 50 years, the currencies would have probably been devalued even further. But, in the new normal, it seems like we're not going to have any more corrections anymore. It looks like this idea has just been completely stamped out. There's no such thing as a bankruptcy anymore because, well, unless you're a small business, of course, in which case nobody cares. But if you're a big company, then, your solvency threatens the solvency of the banking sector and nobody can have that. So they'll go to very long lengths in order to continue to bail you out. How do you see this unfolding over the coming years? Do you see any change in this by any chance?
They maneuvered themselves into a dead end, no? They have a banking system where basically all players are too big to fail, and they are too interconnected to fail, because if one, it's like a domino effect, and we have the big business. If they fail, this would trigger also the meltdown of the whole system, because it's so leveraged, so low equity and so low liquidity. And of course, we have here the governments in the same. Yeah, they cannot permit a corrective crisis where many governments, where people fail, because then the government will have less tax revenues and more spending, and they have to paper over it. If you see in the corona crisis, with more money, with incredible amounts of money. Yeah, and they cannot allow to interest rates to rise, because if interest rates would rise, all these high debtors would get into huge problems. Like, the governments would get into huge problems if interest rates would increase. So the only thing that this European Central Bank, for example, can do is to continue buy up all the debts that the governments are issuing, holding down the interest rates. Yeah. And this, of course, leads to what you also indicated, the zombification. Yeah, we have all these companies that are not dead, but not really alive, that only survive due to the low interest rates, almost zero interest rates, but they suck up, of course, the resources. Yeah, they are not really productive. They would not, in a free market, they would not survive. They don't produce economic growth, but they use resources which could be used by other by new companies. Yeah, if they would be liquidated, the prices of these resources, of these factors of production, would fall, and this would make many projects possible that now are not possible, because these resources are exactly sucked up by these businesses, and of course by government. A way out of this would be, of course, to have interest rates increase, then the zombies would be eliminated. But the problem is, when the zombies are eliminated, the banking system is eliminated, and the governments are also eliminated, because they have
Where's
to,
the problem?
I mean, this is the problem from the perspective of let's say, a central banker who sees the zombies as a problem and wants to get out of this trap of these low interest rates. Let's say there exists a central banker who says, well, I want to get to back to something normal, to something like normal interest rates. Yeah. From this perspective, then we have the problem that he would take down his buddies in the government and the banking system.
Yeah, it's and of course, you know, these things sound apocalyptic when your paycheck depends on them, because for most people, losing your paycheck is apocalyptic. But, you know, people lose their paychecks all the time. And in reality, I think people just need to come to terms with the fact that, you know, taking off the Band-Aid will hurt, but living your life without the Band-Aid is going to just mean a much better life, or taking off the braces, if you want. It's just, you're constantly propping up these companies that are destroying capital. And so as a society, we're getting poorer, because capital resources are being directed toward unproductive uses. You know, we have thousands of workers who wake up every day and go to companies and working in companies that essentially produce things that are worth less than the amount of resources that they're taking up. Of course, you're going to be biased to thinking that this is useful and necessary and important if your paycheck depends on it. But in reality, you know, the way that a market economy functions at all times is that jobs are constantly being destroyed and replaced with more productive jobs and more productive ways of arranging things. And if we had all of this capital freed up to be allocated by entrepreneurs and by the market according to price signals that are not distorted, according to economic calculations with a hard money, then all of these people would be so much more productive. You know, it might hurt for a few months until you learn a new job. And I think... but I think the productivity increase would be enormous. I think where people get stuck on it is that the reality of it is that a lot of people will lose the kind of prestige that is attached with these fake jobs in these insolvent institutions. Instead of working in a government bureaucracy, or instead of working in an industry that's not profitable, people might have to, you know, drive cabs or make pizza. If all of the people that are doing fake jobs were instead driving cabs and making pizza and starting their own businesses, we'd have a much more productive economy, because that's a lot more pizzas and cab rides and real actual things being produced, improving the real quality of life of people, rather than just, you know, everybody making paper profit.
That is something that my friend Thorsten Pollard talks about also. He calls it collective corruption. The fiat money system leads to collective corruption, because almost everyone gets a stake in the system, in the sense that it induces you, for example, to indebt yourself, because the incentive is to indebt yourself and acquire real assets like houses. Then, of course, if you are highly indebted and if you don't indebt yourself, you won't get housing, for example, then, of course, you have this mortgage, maybe even variable rate mortgage. So what you want is that interest rates stay low. Yeah, you want them to stay low. Yeah. So you get like a complice of the banking system. That is the collective correction. And of course, your job, at least in the short run, as you said, it depends that this continues, that the continuous bailout goes on. If you would lose your job, then of course you would have problems to pay back your mortgage. Yeah, and you are highly indebted. So this would get you into problems. And of course, many jobs depend on the government. Yeah. My job, for example, I'm also paid by the government, but this doesn't prevent me from criticizing it, of course. So this gets to this collective corruption. It's very difficult to get out of it. And we have also taken into account that there are like just psychological effects, like a status quo bias, that people like the status quo and they fear the uncertainty. This plays into their hands, of course, also. And people might have a high time preference and be scared. Well, I don't want this insecurity for a few months. I prefer to live with a system which is less productive. I think this is probably main reasons why we have such difficulties to convince, or one of the difficulties why we have difficulties to convince the general population that this has to end. Yeah, I mean, many people see actually problems with the monetary system. Or they have an intuitive feeling. But if you would tell them, well, we need like a general meltdown for a few months, they would probably, they might actually say, yeah, they might actually agree with the argument that their productivity would rise afterwards, but they might actually nevertheless prefer to continue in this.
Yeah, and unfortunately, even though people might think that they would oppose something like this, over the last year, we have seen something like this take place, more or less. It's being called the Great Reset, and all those governments all over the world are actually going along at full speed, with the legitimacy of the fact that everybody is afraid and cooped up in their home and they can't leave their home. Governments are just shutting down entire sectors of the economy and really just performing massive reconstructive surgery on the economic system. A lot of businesses are going out of business and a lot of industries are being supported because a lot more money and spending is going toward them, particularly, the healthcare industry, or at least some parts of the industry. It's incredible, with this... they're using this to essentially destroy a lot of the essential infrastructure industries in modern societies, which is fossil fuels and hydrocarbon energy. And it's amazing when you think the effect of this is going to be, in their mind, I think, people are driven by this idealism where we're going to be replacing everything with pristine, beautiful windmills and clean solar energy, and we'll get to live in a Star Trek world. But in reality, all that's going to happen is we're just going to make energy much more expensive for people. And it's going to be very sad. I think it's just the reversing of hundreds of years of progress, progress being the reduction in the cost of energy. And now it's being reversed because people are going in that direction. So, this is a massive economic reset. We could have gotten on hard money much easier and much faster than trying all of this stuff during this time. We could have had these 6 months of adjustment by switching onto a hard monetary standard. But the good thing is, of course, we don't have to convince people of these things anymore because Bitcoin means never having to try to convince anybody. Bitcoin is implementing its own Great Reset. It's imposing deflationary monetary policy on the world. and it's growing every day. And, you know, people who reject it end up essentially just watching their rejection become more and more expensive with every passing day as Bitcoin continues to work. So,
actually, the cash building, you could argue that something like cash building deflation is occurring in Bitcoin, no? Because people, there's a speculative demand. And you could say that the quality is increasing. The more people use it, the higher the quality of the money. So the more people using Bitcoin, the higher the quality of the money, leading to cash building. And this means price deflation. Yeah. But go ahead.
Yeah, no, this is what I wanted to get to. So first of all, actually, you also wrote about quality of money. Could you tell us a little bit more about that? What do you mean by that concept?
I wrote about it because all people talk only about the quantity of money, while the quality normally is at least as important as the quantity. And my argument is that the price level or the purchasing power of money can change, even though the quantity does not change due to changes in its in the quality. And the quality, I mean, the capacity to fulfill the three functions of money, which is facilitating exchanges, being a good store of value, and calculating. To use
unit
it as
of account.
A unit of account, that it is. Yeah. Yes. So, and this the capacity to fulfill this can change, and they can change rapidly, sometimes overnight. And there are many examples of it. I mean, we had, for example, resumptions to specie payments in the US in the 19th century. That is, they got rid of the redemption in specie. Yeah. And then they return to the redemption. So on this day, obviously, the quality of money changes, because the day before you could go with it, you could not go with your dollar bill and get gold, and the day after you can go and get gold. But the quantity has not changed, but the quality has changed. And of course, the expectation of this to happen had before a very important effect on the quality of money. So there are many qualities. Yeah, so there's a quality to facilitate exchange. And there we have, of course, the transportation costs. And there we have, of course, Bitcoin. It's very good. Security and so on. Homogeneity, which are that fiat money fulfills some of these transaction criteria quite well, but it's not so good at the store value criteria, right? Fiat money is rather also low transportation costs, and it's homogeneous and so on, but it fares very badly in the store value. So my main argument is that we have to take into account the quality of money, which influences the demand for money and thereby the price for money. And the quality of money can change without any changes in the quantity of money. Yeah. And for example, having more users, as I said, when more people use the money, the quantity must not change, but it's in, if people, more people use the money, it's used in more countries, for example, then the quality increases, which would lead to price deflation. Yeah, ceteris paribus. Yeah, that is, yeah, and we have many instances, for example, in wars, yeah, even though the quantity of the money did not change, but the value of the currency changed if there was, if a battle was won or lost. Because if your government goes down, which issues the your fiat currency, then it may become worthless. So if two fiat currency governments are in war with each other and one will win over the other, the fiat currency of the losing part would become worthless or could become worthless. So the outcome of one single battle has direct influences of the quality of the money and the price. And in the foreign exchanges, you could observe it immediately. For example, in the Civil War and U.S. Civil War, if the South would win, well, the Southern currency would go up, and vice versa. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, in this regard, why do you think deflation is not a problem for Bitcoin, or can it be a problem? So, if Bitcoin currently has a market cap where the total supply of all the coins, the total market value of all coins in circulation is around $600 billion, which is a lot, but it's still still less than 1% of the total value of liquid money around the world when you count different kinds of money and gold. So it's still less than 1% of the total global money supply. If it were to become a more prominent part of the global monetary system, one of the common objections we often hear is that, well, you can't do that by printing more Bitcoin, since you can't print more Bitcoin. So the only way to do this would be a massive revaluation of Bitcoin upward. And so Bitcoin's price has to go up a lot in order for it to succeed. And some people think that's a problem, and that, you know, this disqualifies Bitcoin, because, you know, nobody wants to hold a form of money that will appreciate over time. But from your experience, what do you think? Is this likely to be an impediment?
No, this is when something gets monetized, arises as a money, this is what happens. More people start to use it. There starts to be a speculative demand. It is used by more people, so it becomes more attractive. So always when a new money arises in a market process, it's accompanied by a price deflationary process. It may not be impossible, but it's highly unlikely that you get a new money without having a deflationary process. I mean, this actually...
The government can do it.
Yeah, the government can do it. Yeah, this actually makes it more attractive. It's like a self-reinforcing process, because more people demand it, so the price goes up, so it becomes even more attractive to hold it for others. The store of value function is even better fulfilled. The quality rises, and this leads to a higher demand, and the quality rises even higher, and so on. So it's not inhibiting. It's only inhibiting if you buy into all these arguments that falling prices are a problem. But falling prices are not a problem. I mean, for some people maybe, because we all are buyers and sellers. As buyers, we want lower prices. As sellers, we want higher prices. We all buy and sell. We buy goods and services. We sell our labor services or books or whatever. Of course, some people want higher prices. Some people want lower prices. If prices are lower, the buyer wins, the seller loses. But we are all buyers and sellers, so so sometimes we win, sometimes we lose. But it depends.
Yeah, the world in which we have a lot of dropping prices is a world of abundance. Is a world where we have more apples and oranges and coffee and cars and steak and houses and all the things that we want. You know, that's the way that it. The only way that we can make it cheap, the only way that the value of the money can continue to rise is if we're making more of other things. So the fact that people see it as a problem, I think, is very weird.
Prices can also fall, as we said, due to bank rate deflation or cash billing deflation. So not only because of economic growth, but yeah, people think it would be. They actually make the argument. Well, they make it also with the gold standard. They say, You need at least as high an increase in the money supply as productivity grows, no? And which is a totally bullshit argument, of course.
Yeah, and it seems, you know, if you look at the data for gold mining, and this is pretty long-term data, and if you look at it, it seems that gold increases at around 1%, 2% per year. And even though we don't have with gold anything like the accounting capabilities of Bitcoin, where, you know, we know exactly how many Bitcoins exist at every moment in time, with gold, we can't really know. But if you collect data over time, then you're looking at the growth rate, then, you know, errors in reporting can kind of cancel out over time. And so you can get a pretty good idea about the range of annual growth in the supply. And it has been around 1% or 2% for gold for probably the last couple of centuries or so. And it seems like, yeah, around the late 19th century, that was roughly in the same range of average annual economic growth. But it doesn't have to be. And in fact, in your book, you discussed the example of deflation in the US in the late 19th century. Was the money supply keeping up with economic growth?
No, economic growth was faster than the increases in the money supply. There were several factors at the same time. There was also the factor that I mentioned before about the increase in the quality of the money, because they had suspended redemption in specie in the Civil War, and then they resumed it, I think, in 1879. There have been, of course, at the same time also cycles, because there were fraction reserve banking, so there was credit crunch contraction. But if you look at the long term, that was from 1865 when the Civil War ended to 1896. So this is 31 years, pretty long. So I think the commodity price index fall 31%. Of course, there were ups and downs, but overall it fell 31%. Did it inhibit economic growth? No, it was a consequence of economic growth and tremendous economic growth. One of the highest economic growth we had ever seen. Of course, there was also immigration of people, so there was a higher division of labor, but also huge capital accumulation. And the fall in prices did not inhibit anyone to invest. On the contrary, people invested. The highest investment and capital accumulation almost ever experienced. Yeah, this is also, we see it also in the technology sector. Yeah, we know that we have deflationary expectations there. We know that the next iPhone will be, lower in price or higher quality, which is the same. Does it mean that we will not buy this iPhone and wait for the next one? And then when the next one comes, we wait for the next one because we know it will be better. Well, obviously this is stupid. It's also stupid that no one would invest in these sectors, even though prices are falling. These are one of the sectors where we have highest investments. It's the technology sector. Yeah, give me a break. Prices are falling higher quality always, but it does not mean that there's a depression in the sector. No, it's the other way around.
Yeah, absolutely. And, clearly at this point, the deflation that Bitcoin is experiencing, the price deflation of Bitcoin, the increase in the value of Bitcoin is a result not of economic growth. It's not because Bitcoin is a measure of economic growth, because Bitcoin is not, by any stretch of the imagination, the only money that's out there. But it is a deflation because of cash balances. It's a deflation because more and more people are accumulating cash balances in Bitcoin. So we're not going to be witnessing. If you look at Bitcoin over the first 10 years, which just ended, the first full 10 years of trading, the average growth per year over the first 10 years was 205%, I think. So 200% tripled on average every year over 10 years. And so, we can't continue to do that growth forever. There will have to come a point at which it can't grow at that rate. This is a result of the growth in the cash balances, because people are buying and holding more Bitcoin. But if we get to a point where Bitcoin is the dominant money, it won't be tripling every year, but it would be appreciating by as much economic growth as we would be getting, which I think, would be it's interesting to speculate about where we would be in this regard. Imagine if we were still on gold, or if we had adopted Bitcoin, say, 50 years ago, and assume everything else in the world is, it's kind of impossible, but assume everything else in the world, technologically speaking, today is as it is, with the one difference being that in 1971, instead of switching to gold, instead of switching to the dollar, we switched to Bitcoin or a fixed money supply. How much do you think would be the increase in prices every year? Would we be getting on average, say, 3, 5, maybe 10% a year? Or what do you think?
But then you're assuming also that with a fixed money supply, there would not have been wars. There would not, the welfare state would be much smaller. The state size would be much smaller, right?
Yeah, that's a tricky part.
Shall I factor all this in?
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe how much economic growth would be possible in a much freer market? Yeah. Well, yeah, 5%. I don't know. I'm not sure, but probably more than 3%. Maybe 5%.
Yeah, and I think, it's kind of a misleading term in my mind. There's no such thing, obviously, as a general price level. So it makes no sense to talk about a 5% or 3% of the general price level. It's useful maybe as a mental construct, but in reality, some things are just going to get much cheaper, much faster, like digital goods. And then, cheap industrial stuff will get cheaper, but at a lower rate. But things that are scarce will not get much cheaper, So think about prime real estate in the best locations in the world. People are always going to continue to pay top money for that. So, you can't make much more of it. You can't make more, say, South Beach, Miami real estate. There's limits on how much you can make. So these things would not get cheaper all the time. It's amazing when you think about it this way, you know, it makes sense. Things that we make more of continue to get cheaper and they get much more cheap. And things that we can only make a little bit more of only get a little bit cheaper. It's a wonderful world when you think about it. Everything just fits together and begins to make sense.
Yeah, of course, if we have increases in productivity in some sectors, that means, of course, that will spill over to other sectors, even though there's not much increases in productivity. Yeah, just because the opportunity costs change. Yeah, it becomes much cheaper to buy something else, so you can spend more. You can spend more on something else.
Yeah. I noticed in your book, in your intro for your book, as I said, you know, was written 2007 for the PhD. But then when you wrote the intro in 2014, you mentioned Bitcoin in the introduction and you don't get into it in any detail, but you just mentioned one line that you say, well, after the financial crisis, everybody keeps talking about deflation being bad. And also they keep bringing it up as an excuse for why something like Bitcoin can't work or why Bitcoin can't work. I found it interesting because, you know, you've settled the deflation debate about Bitcoin as early as 2014. But you've not written much about it, right? On Bitcoin?
No. I'm not a technological expert on it, and I would have to be able to write about it in detail. I would have to do it, but I think the implications of the deflation book for Bitcoin are quite clear. I mean, I think with it all arguments against deflation that come from this deflationary side are rebutted by the book. It's implicit there, and therefore I guess I put it also into the introduction. I did not remember that, but
course. Yeah, so I guess the question is, have you looked into Bitcoin? Are you interested in it, or is it just theoretical for you, or have you thought about it as a practical economic technology?
I have. I read your book, which I enjoyed very much. Yeah,
glad to hear that. Great, thanks.
Great argument, also very Hobbesian. So this about this fiat aesthetics and music and so on. This is was very attractive to me because I like. I think similar in this also that the cultural consequences of fiat money are tremendous and everything is watered down. So your question was about
if are you a Bitcoiner basically. Can we call you a Bitcoiner yet?
No. No, I'm more a precious metal guy. I'm president of Elementum International, and we offer storage of physical silver in the Swiss Alps, in Switzerland. Yeah, so I may be biased due to this job position. But I guess in the past I was, there are anecdotes I could tell you about my relation with Bitcoin. One is that when my book, deflation book, was translated into Chinese, they offered me, because they said it would be easier, to send me the royalties in Bitcoin. I declined. It was an error, of course, a huge error. Yeah, because it was probably around 2014 or 2015. Yeah.
Have you ran the numbers on just how much that advance would be worth today? Bitcoin's very deflationary.
No, I prefer not to do it, actually.
I think you should. I think you really should. No, and I think
it would feel bad. I would feel bad. Yeah.
No, I think, okay, you'll feel bad, but that will impel you to start acting on it because I think you're committing a similar mistake today.
Then the deflation book, I also sent it to a friend of mine who is a Bitcoiner. And I said it as a gift, of course. And he said, no, I will pay you. I pay you in Bitcoin. So so I have 0.1 Bitcoin and since 2015, I guess. And there they are. Now they are already worth something. So, yeah. So these are the anecdotes. But I guess it's very speculative, yeah. And if it does not become money, then the value can drop a lot. If it becomes money, yeah, I know you make the argument it's like asymmetric, right? You make some, it's like an asymmetric bet, and that's true. Yeah, but maybe I'm too conservative investor to make this.
I think actually you're too reckless. You're taking a massive risk because you get the fact that it can happen. And in fact, you see it happening. You know, if you look at it, Bitcoin right now is at around $34,000 a Bitcoin. So, you know, it's, if it was becoming money, this is exactly what it would look like. We're exactly on schedule because it's been increasing at about tripling every year over 10 years. So like, I can't imagine anybody, like if I asked you 10 years ago that we're going to have a new form of money, and it's going to triple every year on average over the next 10 years. Objectively, you look at that. If somebody told me that, I think, yeah, well, this is what success would look like. You know, I can't imagine it growing much faster than that. This is, for me, success would have been, you know, 20% a year would have been pretty successful. But if you think about it, 200% a year, it is effectively becoming money. So really, what's really risky is not having any exposure to what could become essentially the global monetary standard. You know, your grandchildren will never forgive you if you.
Well, I have 0.1 Bitcoin, so this should be $3,400, right? And if the asymmetric bet goes well, this should be worth much more, right?
Yeah, I guess.
What do you think about governments? Do you think that they will bystand? Don't you think that they might forbid Bitcoin? I know that they can't, in the sense that practically they cannot interfere, but they could. What could they do? They could say, well, if you do it, you get such and such penalty, and if we get behind you, they could make fake buyers and sellers and try to get to you.
Yeah, I think, some governments have imposed these kinds of restrictions. And obviously, you know, this is essentially an entrepreneurial call. There's nothing about that we can think about in economic theory that can predict how this is going to really play out. So the risk is always there. But I think there are a couple of things that once you get them, once you think about how Bitcoin has been evolving, you see that effectively, on the one hand, it's a technology that is its job much better than its predecessors. So if you think about it as a technological improvement in money, you say gold is better than silver because it has better weight ratio and it's more scarce and it's less inflationary. Bitcoin is, if gold was 10 times better than silver, Bitcoin is maybe 1,000 times better than gold because its inflation drops to zero, its adoption is very low, you're able to buy it at a very early stage, and it's much faster to move around. It's digital, so in terms of its salability across space, it's just a much more powerful technology for doing money. And in my mind, I think what's happening over the last few years is that as people understand it, whether it's as individuals or as corporations or as government officials, once they understand the implications of it, the natural response seems to be not let's ban it, but let's get as much as we can. Let's get our hands on it. Let's not let others get to it before us. And so I personally, you know, I thought up until 2012, 13, 14, I expected that Bitcoin was going to get banned and it was going to go through a lot of persecution. I really did not think that in 2020 we'd be in a world in which, you know, major Wall Street banks and major publicly listed corporations are accumulating Bitcoin and putting it on their balance sheet, and it is getting custodied and stored by some of the biggest names in finance. So I didn't think this was likely to happen. I thought it would be far more of a black and gray market, and alternative market to the current financial system. But on the one hand, it seems like there's this aspect of it's just better technology, and so people want to hold it. And then on the other hand, you have to keep in mind that banning it is just very, very difficult in a practical sense, if not impossible. In a sense, ultimately, in order for Bitcoin to continue to work, you just need a few devices all over the world to communicate every 10 minutes and arrive at consensus about the next block. So every 10 minutes, you need a few hundred or a few thousand devices around the world to send and receive 1 or 2 megabytes. So the technical requirements that are needed for Bitcoin to continue to operate are essentially nothing, you know, and it doesn't even need the internet. You can, a lot of these devices can even communicate over radio and satellite.
Yeah, but stores like grocery stores or Amazon, they could not sell in Bitcoin if it would be banned.
That's true, but I think, you know, let's take the other thought experiment where they try and crack down on it and they try and ban it. At that point, you still are able to exchange your Bitcoins. Okay, you can't pay with it online in the supermarket on Amazon maybe, but you can still settle physical Bitcoin if you want, you know. In a sense, you can't do that with gold because if they ban you from settling gold, you know, you can't settle it with the banks, the few gold banks. But with Bitcoin, the clearance that happens for Bitcoin can happen very easily, and it requires very little technical capacity. And therefore, you know, it becomes, if you're a bureaucrat, you know, you have an enormous incentive to play along with Bitcoin, to hold Bitcoin, to want to accumulate it and to benefit from it. On the other hand, if you want to fight it, you've got an enormous battle in front of you that is going to require a level of police state totalitarianism that is enormous and extremely expensive and is going to be very unpopular and is going to be ineffective. You know, ultimately, you can't stop people from using machines, and then there's all the, you know, redundancies that can be used. So when you factor in those two factors, it seems so far that, you know, at least in the major Western economies, it's looking increasingly like that ship of banning has sailed. Even in China, that ship of the idea that they're going to clamp down and make a general ban, I think it seems extremely unlikely at this point. Like the caliber of the people and the financial interests that hold Bitcoin at this point are, it's become like its own pressure group in politics, that it's, you have a small number of people, but they are extremely motivated around this one issue. So the idea that you could just pass legislation that will clamp down on it completely is not very likely. And also, even if it were to happen in one country, effectively what ends up happening is that, you know, other countries end up getting getting an advantage in Bitcoin adoption compared to that country. So you can kind of, you're kind of shooting yourself in the foot if you ban it and other countries don't ban it, and then they end up adopting more of it. So all of these seem to suggest that it might be a little too risky, not to be holding Bitcoin rather than holding it.
Well, let me make one more argument. For Bitcoin to become money, it would have to be used in daily exchanges as well. So that means that we would pay in the grocery store, on Amazon, we would pay everything with Bitcoin, and the state would have to permit that. I mean, it would be, of course, the state could not crack down and that you could not use it as a store of value or a financial asset, but to use it in this daily exchanges, it could just say to all grocery stores, you have to use euros or you have to use dollars. I don't see that the state would allow Bitcoin, would just give up in this sense, because it depends so much on the control on the money supply. The power of the state depends so much on it, on having dollars or control the euro supply, the size of the state. They gain through the banking system, of course, and also interest in it. And they are also, for example, in the European Eurozone, they made the step forward introducing a digital euro. They want to introduce a digital euro, and this would be, of course, horrible because we would not have black markets anymore. It would be more difficult to evade taxes. They could control all our transactions. I think this is actually what they want. They want to be able to see all our transactions with the digital euro, digital fiat money. They would be able to do it. They would get rid of cash. Then they could install negative interest rates as low as they want, because no one could get the cash anymore of their banks, because everything is digital. If this is their plan, I don't think there will be a level playing field for Bitcoin. So I don't think that they will give up without fighting as much as they can against it. This does not rule out, of course, that they let Bitcoin exist for investment reasons, as an investment vehicle and for international transactions. But for the daily transactions or the labor contracts, they could institute a law where they say, well, all labor contracts have to be paid in digital euros. So I don't think this is too far.
Yeah, I mean, I think... The way that I think of that is what you're describing is essentially any of your average third world monetary shitholes, where they have a terrible shitcoin national currency and the government is passing all kinds of laws that, you know, you can't use the dollar for paying this and you have to use our local peso or lira or whatever it is to pay for it. So, you know, in these places, okay, so people will continue to use the local currency as it starts getting into chunks that are very big. People will pay 5 million pesos or liras for a sandwich. And they clamp down on the use of the dollar and they make the dollar illegal. But check back 5 years later, what has happened to the value of the peso or the lira next to the dollar in those 5 years? Right? The peso and the lira continue to collapse. And all of those laws don't prevent economic reality from imposing itself. So I think there is a possibility that we could see this kind of Bitcoin parallel system exist where, you know, you have to use the national currency for all the things that are legal and politically correct and approved by your government. So, and you see it, you know, with the promotion of things like UBI and with the recent lockdown and the way that this is being marketed. Effectively, you can see how, you know, basically if you're tied into the fiat economy, you are being given fake money to buy fake food and to stay at home and watch a fake reality on your TV screen. As long as all of the things that you're consuming are cheap industrial stuff, then that system can continue to exist. And inflation in terms of prices won't necessarily explode. So we won't necessarily get hyperinflation very quickly. But, you know, this becomes like the dysfunctional lira economy in Lebanon today, which is just now it's government employees and government subsidized goods. And these are the people that are really using liras mostly, but everybody else is trying to, everybody's trying their best as much as they can to use dollars more and more. And in 5 years' time, I think we're just going to witness more dollars and more dollar purchasing power compared to the lira. You know, we're going to have a lot more liras, obviously. They're going to continue to print more and more liras. But the value is just going to continue to decline. So the end result of this is that you put the local shitcoin out of its misery and you dollarize in fiat currencies. And that's what happened in, say, Ecuador, where that's how they got rid of inflation. They just went on the dollar. Maybe these two parallel systems can exist for a while. But, you know, even if you think about it this way, the kind of demand that would exist for Bitcoin in a world like this is arguably many magnitudes larger of the demand that exists today, because still today, it's still a very small market share. And so in that kind of world in which everything is surveilled and everything is controlled and, you know, you're getting your money from the government, and you're only allowed, you know, it's only a matter of time before they ban you from eating meat and you're only allowed to spend your fiat money on fiat food and soy, for instance. And so all of the thought criminals who still believe in eating meat are going to have to resort to things like Bitcoin. So in a sense, these clampdowns, when you think about them, when you think about their economic impact, you know, what is the impact of telling people that you can't use your money for buying Bitcoin, or you can't use your money for buying things that are for buying fossil fuels or for buying meat. If you, the more you do of these things, the more you're just underscoring the value proposition of Bitcoin, and the more you're advertising Bitcoin. So I think if we head in this direction, the direction of them fighting Bitcoin by also restricting the freedom of what you can do with your own money, I think even in that case, we still have a majorly bullish case for Bitcoin. But it's looking increasingly likely that, you look at where the world is going right now. Visa, just yesterday, they had a conference call and they were saying that, they are contemplating adding Bitcoin as another currency in the currencies that they can use. So then you'll be able to make Visa payments. Visa, yeah. So, Bitcoin's already on PayPal, and it's already on Cash App, and it's already on all kinds of mainstream financial institutions that are beginning to use it. So, I'm not saying it's impossible that these things will happen, but I think it's... I think what I would tell you is the case of this not happening and the case of Bitcoin continuing to do what it has been doing for the last 10 years, I think is probably, it's something worth accounting, worth taking into account, and worth speculating on, if you want, in terms of having a small position in. This is the case that I would make.
Yeah, no, you make a good case. No, you make a good case. Yeah.
No. Also, we want you on Bitcoin Twitter. We need you to be dunking on all the inflationists and all the people who talk about deflation. We need you.
Yeah. No. I will always defend deflation. I get sometimes fed up with all the bullshit I have to read on Twitter. But
yeah. Exactly. This is why we need you. All right. So what questions do you guys have? Peter wanted to ask you about the euro. Peter, you want to go ahead?
I came across your work originally by reading your book, The Tragedy of the Euro. And I thought that was a really fascinating overview of some of the economic conflicts that exist at the heart of the euro. Obviously, that was written back in 2010. So we've come along. There's been quite a lot of passage of time since the book's publication. So I just wondered if you could provide a bit of an update on what you see as being how the euro has played out in the last 10 years since the publication. Has it played out as you've expected? Do you think the euro is at a fragile stage at the moment? And I'd be curious to hear in particular your thoughts on a lot of the European Central Bank corporate bond buying that we've been seeing stepping up during the coronavirus period.
Well, it's great to hear that people read my euro book. Also, it has been, as you maybe remember, I say there are three possibilities for the future. One is that we get to a reform, stability and growth pact, and people will behave, that is, countries will behave, and the commons, that is, the exploitation of the purchasing of the currency will be limited, and everyone plays with the rules. With 3% of GDP, or make it zero, that would of course imply harsh reforms in some countries. Yeah, so this was the first possibility, and we have seen steps in this direction. There has been reforms in some states, actually harsh reforms that would not have been possible or imaginable without. And for some time, also the deficits came down. Yeah, well, the second option was. There will be a breakup. There has been steps in this direction also. Yeah, Greece was actually very, very close to break up in 2015. They, you might remember, that they had, for the third bailout, the ECB asked for certain reforms. And they say basically no, or we will make a referendum if the population agrees. We will give the people the right to decide if they want it. And the people said no, we don't want the reforms that the EU Commission and the ECB wants to impose on us. And then the ECB said, okay, then we will close you the liquidity. That is, we will tap the emergency liquidity assistance, which is called, where the Greek central bank can give loans to their banking system on their own risk, and they can decide which kind of collateral they accept. And they said, we freeze it. And in this moment, they had to make a bank holiday, because Greeks were getting their money out of the banks and transferring it to other countries, but they did not have more reserves. So the country was, and in this moment, actually the German finance minister said, let Greece go. Finally, the French position prevailed to keep them in, and they stayed in, but it was close. So we could have had this. And the third option that I said was we go in the direction of a European super state, of more centralization, more inflation, harmonization. And there's where we are heading. No, we have seen this. There has been actually the European Fiscal Compact, which was like a harsher copy of the Stability and Growth Pact, but countries did not fulfill this. They had higher deficits. So, and the European Central Bank started to buy government bonds on the secondary market, which was clearly against the meaning of the treaty, the Maastricht Treaty. And they made it actually like a regular business to do it every month. Now they started to buy corporate bonds. So the ECB has immensely increased its power. The governments are now also higher indebted. And there has been propositions to install European finance minister, which would be, of course, a step towards a European super state. So we have seen many steps in this direction, but it's not settled yet which of the three scenarios we will see. It could still be that someone leaves the euro and not very likely, but it could still be that they restrict their spending and go on to in the austerity way. Path and the path of austerity. But the most likely I see now is that we go towards more centralization, which means, of course, in the long run, also more inflation. Yeah. So this is basically how it played out. Yeah, basically, you can interpret it very well, what has happened with the theoretical instruments of the book and these three different solutions to the tragedy of the commons, the tragedy of the euro.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Well, thank you so much, Philip. This was a lot of fun. I enjoyed this conversation a lot. And I hope we've convinced you and gotten you to think more about joining us in the Bitcoin adventure. Thank you so much. And I hope we'll be having you again on here to discuss more about economics and deflation and all these wonderful topics. Thanks again.
Yeah, thank you, Saif Dayan. This was a great pleasure and fun for me also. And yeah, you made a good argument. I will think about it. Thank you.
Excellent. Thanks.